The topic is Brentano on will and emotion, and the structure of the presentation is pretty straightforward. I'm going to discuss first Brentano's theory of the will, then his theory of emotion. It will turn out that they are very similar theories, and then the question will be, if these are your theories of will and emotion, is it that, does it turn out that there is no real difference between will and emotion? And the answer, ultimately the answer in my opinion is no, even in Brentano. But it will be tricky to see why. So I start with Brentano's theory of the will. As an analytic philosopher, I am going to relate Brentano's theories of the will and emotion to current theories of will and emotion in contemporary analytic philosophy. It's just parti pris, as you say, I think. So there are three main theories of the will in current analytic philosophy, one which takes as the essence of the will and states of the will, like desire, decision, intention, etc., that it motivates the subject to behave in certain ways. The difference between the cognitive and the conative is that the conative is connected to action, to motivation and action, in a way that the cognitive is not. So that's one leading theory. I will say more about it soon. Another theory uses the notion of directional fit, which I will introduce in due course, and ultimately we will get to the third type of theory, which understands states of the will, like desire, intention, and decision, as evaluative representations. All right, so my claim will be that Brentano belongs to the third group, but has a particular version of it, which in my opinion is better than all the versions that you get in the current analytic philosophy of mind. So I'm starting with the idea that the essence of the will is its motivational role, the way that it motivates you to action. Here's a classic statement of the view in contemporary analytic philosophy. You have as the paradigmatic state of the cognitive belief and the paradigmatic state of the conative part of the mind, desire. And Stolnaker says, belief and desire are correlative dispositional states of a potentially rational agent. To desire that P is to be disposed to act in ways that would tend to bring it about, that P, in a world in which one's beliefs, whatever they are, were true. To believe that P is to be disposed to act in ways that would tend to satisfy one's desires, whatever they are, in a world in which P were true. So this is a bit complicated, but I just want to focus on the idea that to desire that P, for example, to desire that I drink beer. Suppose I have a desire for beer. What is it to desire to drink beer? It is to be disposed to act in ways that would tend to bring it about that pee. It would bring it about that I'm drinking beer. In a world in which one's beliefs, whatever they are, were true. So if I believe that I'm at home and that there is beer in the refrigerator, then my desire is a disposition to go. What is to desire to have beer? It's just to be disposed to go to the refrigerator to open it to get a beer out. That's what it means to desire to drink a beer. Now I believe that I am not at home. I am in a seminar room, and I believe that the bar has beer afterwards. Maybe we will go and we'll get beer. And these are my beliefs, and my desire will is a kind of mental state that will dispose me to walk to the bar after when I'm finished with we are finished with the seminar. This is what it means to desire to drink beer, to be in a have certain dispositions to act. Now, whatever the merits of this view, it cannot be Brentano's view. It's very, very distant from the way Brentano thinks about our mental life. So there are two principles of Brentano's descriptive psychology, is this program that he calls descriptive psychology, that involves certain central principles, and two of these principles conflict immediately with this dispositional approach or motivational approach to desire. The first principle is that there are no dispositional mental states. For Brentano, all mental life is conscious. All mental life is something that occurs, that it's all a matter of acts and events, things that are actually taking place. It's not just disposition for something to occur. So think of classic disposition like fragility. What does it mean to say that the vase is fragile? Nothing has to actually happen for the vase to be fragile. For it to be fragile, it just needs to be disposed to break in certain circumstances. So fragility doesn't imply that anything is actually happening. But in Brentano's psychology, all mental phenomena are conscious events and acts. They are things that are actually happening. Something must actually be happening. So he doesn't believe that there are dispositional mental states. He thinks there are dispositions to be in mental states, but those dispositions are not mental states themselves. So Stolnaker thinks, for example, in his functional way, dispositional way of thinking of mental states, that the people outside the room, almost all of them, all the people in the hallway right now, they believe, right now, they have the belief, among their mental states is the belief that 12.77523 is bigger than 8.2721. Now, that belief is not something that's actually happening. It's just the disposition that they have, the disposition, for example, to say that they accept this proposition if you ask them. If you ask them, do you think that 12.77 da, 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 is more than 8.12, they'll say yes, I think. And so this disposition constitutes a mental phenomenon. Brentano says, no, that's not a mental phenomenon. That's just the neurophysiological information in the brain. It's not a mental phenomenon. All mental phenomena are conscious events that are actually occurring, and of which you have, because they're conscious, you are aware of them. You have inner perception of their occurrence. So for Brentano, this is the second principle. Mental phenomena are not invisible entities that you posit in order to explain visible behavior. This is the conception of mental phenomena that we get in modern philosophy of mind and cognitive science a lot of the time. What is belief? What is desire? It's the kind of thing that we attribute to other people to explain their observable behavior. So they behave in certain way. They walk to the fridge, they take out a beer. We say, why did they go to the fridge and take out a beer? They must have a desire. This desire is a theoretical posit. We have no access to it, but we posit it because it explains something that we do have direct access to, which is behavior. Brentano has a completely different view. He thinks that what is mental is essentially what appears to you in inner perception. So you have, with every conscious event that takes place in your mind, you have inner perception of its occurrence. And mental states of which no one has any inner perception are not possible. Okay? And so these dispositions of which Stolnaker speaks, they could be They're dispositions, so they're not necessarily something that is visible. You cannot really see that the vase is fragile. You can see that the vase breaks. You can understand intellectually that the vase is fragile, but you don't directly see the fragility of the vase. And likewise, you do not perceive in inner perception the disposition to walk somewhere. You cannot inner perceive dispositions, only occurrent events. So that cannot be Brentano's view. What about the idea of directional fit? This is a very influential idea since Anscombe in Analytic Philosophy of Mind. The idea that the essential difference between belief and desire is in terms of in which case the mind is supposed to fit the world and in which case the world is supposed to fit the mind. So belief is the kind of state that is supposed to fit the way the world is. I change my mind when I acquire beliefs. I change my mind to reflect the way the world is. A desire is the kind of state that the world is supposed to fit. When I have a desire for something, I don't change my mind to fit the world. Rather, I try to change the world to fit my mind. That's what it means that my mind is having a desire. So compare believing that I have a very cool car versus desiring to have a very cool car. This is a Chrysler from 1956, I think. And I do not own one, but I would like to own one. And so I do not have the belief that I have such a car, but I have the desire to have such a car. What does it mean that I have the desire? It means that in the right circumstances, I would try to change the world so that it fits my mind. My mind has a certain desire. I'm trying to change the world so that it fits a mind that has this kind of desire. If I believed, to believe that I have a car is not to try to change the world to fit the mind. You try to change the mind to fit the world. If someone gives me this car as a present, I will change my mind from a state in which I believe that I don't have the car to a state in which I believe that I do have this car, so that my mind fits the way the world is. So that's the idea of directional fit. In belief, the mind is supposed to fit the world. In desire, the world is supposed to fit the mind. Now, there are various problems with this view. One problem is nobody really has a clear idea of what it means, what directional fit exactly means in the concrete life of the mind. The main theories of directional fit try to explain it in terms of causal dispositions. And in that, if they do that, this theory just becomes a version of the theory we already discussed, and which is incompatible with the basic tenets of Brentano's descriptive psychology. There is also another problem, which is that it seems like there is a reason why in believing that something is the case, I try to change my mind to fit the world. And in desiring that something is the case, I try to change the world so it fits my mind. There's something about the nature of belief and the nature of desire that makes them such that these directions of fit hold of them. It doesn't seem like the having of directional fit, that's the end of the explanation. This is the most basic fact about belief and desire. It seems to be some kind of fact that itself has a deeper explanation. And the question is, what is this deeper feature of belief and deeper feature of desire that explain their different directions of fit? Now, Brentano does not discuss directions of fit at all because it's just not in the air in his time, this kind of notion. So I'm going to not even address the question of whether his view was like that. But I want to switch now to a third view that you find in analytic philosophy of mind, in which I think Brentano did hold. So this view is stated pretty clearly by Dennis Stamp in a paper from 1987 called The Authority of Desire. He says, while the belief in the desire that pee, for example, that I'll drink a beer at 6, have the same propositional content and represent the same state of affairs, there is a difference in the way that state of affairs is represented. In belief, it is represented as obtaining, whereas in desire, it is represented as a state of affairs, the obtaining of which would be good. This modal difference explains why a desire that P is a reason to make it true that P, while the belief that P is not. So if you look just at the portion that discusses desire, he says, in desire, the state of affairs is represented as a state of affairs, the obtaining of which would be good. Whereas in belief, it's represented as a state. So if I believe that I'm drinking beer, I'm representing the state of affairs of me drinking beer as obtaining. Whereas if I desire that I drink beer, I don't represent the state of affairs of me drinking beer as obtaining. I represent it as a state of affairs, the obtaining of which would be good. It would be good if that state of affairs were to obtain. And this seems to be also Brentano's view of the difference between belief and desire, or more specifically between judgment, in Brentano's terminology, between judgment and will. So Brentano writes, if something can become the content of a judgment in that it can be accepted as true or rejected as false, it can also become the object of a desire in that it can be agreeable in the broadest sense of the word as something good or disagreeable as something bad. So belief, in believing that I'm drinking beer, I'm accepting the proposition that I'm drinking beer is true. In desiring that I drink beer, I experience the state of affairs of me drinking beer as something agreeable or good, pleasant maybe, pleasant or good. Now, this kind of evaluative approach to desire and more generally to the will has several advantages over the approaches we've already seen. First of all, if desire presents something as good, and that's what's essential about it, so that the property of being goodness presenting, that's the essential property of desire, then that's not a dispositional property. It's not that the desire is just disposed to do something. It really is presenting the state of affairs as good. Moreover, this kind of property or feature, the goodness presentation, every desire has this feature in it. It's goodness presenting. It presents whatever it does as good. And that can be manifest or is manifest to inner perception, according to Brentano. At least there's no reason to see why it wouldn't be manifest to inner perception. And moreover, it explains our causal dispositions. So why am I disposed to go to the bar? I'm disposed to go to the bar and buy a beer because my desire presents as good my having a beer. And this is how I think I'm going to get a beer, by going to the bar and buying it. So this is the first tenet of Brentano's theory of the will, that the essence of desire is to commit to the goodness of that which is desired, the object of desire. The object of desire is something that the desire represents as good. I formulated it in this analytic sounding way, out of habit. I call this thesis evaluative D, It's the thesis that any desire D for an object O essentially commits to the goodness of O. So there are two parts of this in this. First, the desire, every desire, commits to the goodness of the desired, the thing being desired, the object of desire. The desire commits to it, to the goodness of it. And the second part of it is, it does so essentially. It is in the essence of desire to do that. You cannot have a mental state which is a desire, but does not present as good its object. It's in the essence of desire to present what it does as good. But Brentano's theory has another tenet, which conflicts with Stamp's view, and in my opinion, makes Brentano's theory better. I should mention that evaluative D does not yet tell us anything about the nature of this goodness commitment. It says there's this feature of goodness commitment, but what kind of feature is it? That's open. Stamp has a theory. It says that every desire is really a form of perception. It's perception of the good. It's perception of value. To desire something is to perceive something, is to perceive its goodness. To desire beer is to perceive the goodness of beer. There's the beer there, and I perceive its goodness. Just like I perceive the brownness or the beigeness of the chair in front of me. I also perceive the goodness of the beer. That's Stamp's view. That is not Brentano's view. On the contrary, Brentano says the following. I don't think that anyone will understand me to mean that desires are cognitive acts, judgments or perceptions, by which the goodness of or badness, value or disvalue of certain objects are perceived. Still, in order to make such an interpretation absolutely impossible, I explicitly note that this would be a complete misunderstanding of my real meaning. First, that would mean that I view these phenomena as judgments, but in fact, I set them apart as a separate class. So Brentano says, to desire a beer is not to perceive its goodness or judge that it's good. It presents the beer as good, but it presents it in a sui generis way, a way that only desire presents goodness. And when you look into the details of what this other way is, here's how I like to put it. Goodness commitment. Here are three mental states that can be said to represent goodness. The belief that chocolate is good. So I made these PowerPoints before lunch, so I was thinking of chocolate. Now that it's late afternoon, I'm thinking of beer, but you can substitute them freely if you want. So believing that chocolate is good, that represents the chocolate as good. It represents the goodness of chocolate. Perceiving the chocolate's goodness. Remember that perceiving doesn't necessarily mean visually. Maybe gustatorially you perceive, you say, ah, this chocolate is fantastic. You eat it, and gustatorially you perceive the fantasticness of the chocolate. And then there's desire for chocolate, which also presents the chocolate as good. But an interesting phenomenon here that you'll notice is that the goodness appears in the content of the belief and the perception. Part of what you perceive is goodness. Part of what you believe has to do with goodness. So the goodness is part of what is believed, is the content of the belief. It's part of the object believed. Likewise, perception, part of the thing being perceived is the goodness of the chocolate. But here, where is goodness? You can't see it. Brentano's idea is you can't see it because it's in the very nature of desire. It's hidden in this word, as it were. It's in the very essence of desire to be good. So here's how I would put it. If you look at the intentional structure of the belief that chocolate is good, Here is the intentional structure. The belief has a certain mode under which it presents the content. The content is chocolate is good. That's the content of the belief. It's a belief that chocolate is good. What is the relationship, the intentional relationship? What is the mode of the intentional relationship we have towards this proposition when we believe that chocolate is good? It's the mode of presenting as true. This is what belief does. It presents what it does as true. This belief presents what it does as false. So belief presents as true that chocolate is good. Perception presents as real chocolate's goodness. Think of Sartre and his theory of the difference between perception and imagination. He says, what is the difference? Well, he says many things, but the central thing is that for Sartre, when you perceive a chair, your mental state has a special intentional relation to the chair, which presents as real the chair. When you imagine a chair, you have a different intentional relation that represents the chair under another mode. It presents it as non-existent, as unreal. So perception of the goodness of chocolate in a gustatory experience, for example, presents as real chocolate's goodness. But desire presents as good. That's the essence of desire. That's the intention, that's the sui generis intentional relation that desire has to its object. It doesn't present as true something, it doesn't present as real something, it presents as good, whatever it does. And that's why, while you have here in these statements, you have the word goodness and the word good as part of the content of the state. Here I said, right, that this was hidden, the goodness was not part of the content. You don't desire that the chocolate be good, you just desire chocolate. I mean, you can also desire that the chocolate is good, but even when you just desire chocolate, you're already committing to you evaluating the chocolate. But the evaluation, I said, was hidden in the word desire, because desire, what is to desire? It's to present as good. So it's not part of the intentional object, it's part of the mode of the intentional relation, or it's part of the attitudes that we take towards the chocolate. It's the attitude of experiencing as good. So you can see the difference between the goodness being part of the content and the goodness being part of the mode or attitude. And that's the special way in which desire is evaluative. The sui generis way in which it's evaluative. And here's how Brentano puts it. The essence of will consists in a particular relation of the mental activity to the object as good or bad. It's a particular relation to the object. It's not that the object, you don't experience a good object. You experience as good an object. I'm going to repeat this. You don't experience a good object, or you don't experience an object as good. You experience as good an object. What you experience is just the object, but you experience it as good. That's just the relation that you have towards the object. All right, so I said that there are two principles in Brentano's theory of the will. The first was that any desire D for an object O essentially commits to the goodness of O. I mentioned that this principle does not yet tell us anything about the nature of the goodness commitment. The second principle does. I call it attitudinal D. It's not the most beautiful name for a thesis, but it will do. It says this: a desire D's commitment to the goodness of an object is an attitudinal property of D. What it means is that it's part of the very mode of intentionality, part of the attitude that you take towards the object. It's not part of the object being experienced. It's part of the attitude, the experiential attitude towards the object, all right? So the combination of evaluative D and attitudinal D captures the essence of desire and, more generally, the will for Brentano. So if we do a quick taxonomy of where Brentano fits in the contemporary logical geography of theories of the will, there are three main theories of the will in contemporary analytic philosophy of mind. One in terms of motivational role, one in terms of directional fit, one the evaluative theory. And in the evaluative theory, there are two kinds. One that's based on the content, that you perceive the goodness, as in Stamps' theory, and one that is attitudinal, as in Brentano's theory. So Brentano really has, this is Brentano's theory of the will. This is where it is. It's an attitudinal version of the evaluative theory. It's different from everything. I don't know of any theory in current philosophy of mind that has this. And I guess I'm not arguing for this here, but I do think it's the best theory. It's better than all these other theories that are being debated now. So in conclusion of part one, how is it already 4:50 and I'm only in part one? I defended the one version of the evaluative theory of will as Brentano's theory. What about the theory of emotion? Here it's actually very common in contemporary analytic philosophy of mind to think of emotion is essentially evaluative. If you are happy that the weather is nice, that evaluates the weather being nice as a good thing. If you're sad that the weather is nice, you're evaluating the weather being nice as a bad thing. Suppose you're sad because you want to take a ski vacation in April, and you think, oh, if the weather is nice, there's not going to be snow in April. So you're sad about it. So what does it mean to be sad about it? It's, well, one of the things that are implied in being sad about the weather being nice is evaluating the state of affairs negatively, the state of affairs of the weather being nice. So this is a common idea, actually, in contemporary philosophy of mind. Here's how Dahms and Jacobson put it. Most recent accounts of the structure of emotion, despite their differences, agree that emotions somehow present the world to us as having certain value-laden features. Following their lead, we will say that emotions evolve evaluative presentations. Value-laden features. It sounds like a complicated way to say good or bad. Although there are different ways to be of being good. So, in admiring Shakespeare, you have this emotion of admiration towards Shakespeare. You present, that admiration presents as good Shakespeare. But there's a particular kind of good. The admirability is the kind of goodness. There are other kinds of goodness which are not admirability. No example comes to my mind, but I'm sure there are. But think of negative emotions. Being afraid of something versus being frustrated with something. Both of them present that something as negatively. But it's a different kind of negative value. The kind that's entrained by fear and the kind that's entrained by frustration. Anyway, that is clearly also Brentano's view. Because he writes, there is a third class of mental states whose phenomena we designated as emotions. Now, just as every judgment takes an object to be true or false, in an analogous way, every phenomenon which belongs to this class takes an object to be good or bad. All right, so the emotions, like the will, present what they do as good or bad. And again, there are versions of this view that try to reduce the emotional evaluation to judgment or to perception. So in contemporary theories of emotion, you have the view of Solomon, Robert Solomon, who claims that to admire a colleague is just to judge that she is admirable. It's just a judgment. It's a judgment that she's admirable. That's all it is to admire someone. He actually maintains that to love someone just is to judge that they are lovely. It's a very bizarre view, very unromantic view, I suppose. A slightly less unromantic view is the Sousa's view, which says that to be afraid of a dog is just to perceive its dangerousness. So this is to reduce emotional evaluation to perceptual evaluation. So what is it to love someone? Is to perceive their loveliness. You just sense their loveliness. To admire someone is to perceive their admirability. But again, Brentano's view will be that no, there's a sui generis way of presenting is good, and the difference between believing that Shakespeare is admirable, perceiving Shakespeare's admirability, and admiring Shakespeare is that the belief that Shakespeare is admirable presents as true the content, Shakespeare is admirable. The perception presents as real Shakespeare's admirability, but the admiration just presents as admirable, where admirable is one kind of goodness. Remember, loveliness is another kind of goodness. That's a good example. What is it for me to love my wife? It's to present as lovely. I have to have mental state, a sui generis mental state that presents as lovely my wife. What is presented is just my wife, nothing more than that. The loveliness comes in the very attitude of being related to my wife a certain way. So, Brentano's theory of emotion, we're going to state it very quickly. It has two claims, evaluative E, which is just like evaluative D, except it says any positive emotion about an object O essentially commits to the goodness of O. Every negative emotion about the object of O, about an object O, essentially commits to the badness of O. And the second claim will be what I call attitudinal E, which is like attitudinal D, but about emotion. It says that an emotion E is commitment to the goodness or badness of an object O is an attitudinal property. It's part of the way you relate to the object. It's not part of the object you're relating to. Now, there is one modern friend in the literature on emotion in Geneva, a modern friend of Brentano, Julien Deonat and Fabrice Théroni. They have a book, a textbook in French on emotion, which is fantastic. I read the English version, I confess, but apparently they told me it's exactly the same. It's a fantastic book, and they defend there a view that commits to both attitudinal E and evaluative E, these two theses. Here's one place where they write something relevant. They say, if we now take the idea of evaluative properties as the formal objects of emotions at face value, danger in the case of fear, offensiveness in the case of anger. This appears to imply that the fact that emotions have evaluative properties amongst their correctness conditions traces back to the fact that they have specific attitudes, evaluative attitudes, and not to the fact that they have a specific content. So there's a lot of jargon here about correctness conditions. Don't worry about that. There's just fearing a dog evaluates the dog negatively, but that traces back to the fact that there's a certain attitude, an evaluative attitude being employed towards the dog. It's not part of the content. It's not that I don't experience a dangerous dog. Rather, I experience as dangerous a dog. the dog is the only thing I'm experiencing, but I'm experiencing the dog in a certain way, the as dangerous way. Now, there is still a big difference, though, between Deona and Theoni on the one hand and Brentano on the other, which is their particular view of what kind of attitudinal or modal property this presenting as good or presenting as bad is in the case of emotion. They basically think that it has to do with the bodily sensations that you have when you have an emotion. So, I don't remember now if anyone discussed, I haven't been to every talk in the seminar in the last 2 years, but I've been to at least 70%. I don't remember being anyone discussing the James Lange theory of emotion, the very first theory of emotion that said emotion is just the feeling of bodily sensations. So in the case of fear, you're going to have butterflies in your stomach. So of course it's just a metaphor, but it's some kind of sensation, visceral sensation. And the feeling of that visceral sensation, that's all there is to fear, according to James and Lange. Deona and Theoni don't think that that's all there is to fear, but they think that these bodily sensations that William James focuses on, they are the attitudes. When the sensation is pleasant, it presents as good the object. When the sensation is unpleasant, it presents as bad. So the presenting is done by these sensations. Here's what they write. But how exactly are we to understand emotions conceived as evaluative attitudes? We can answer this question, we suggest, by elaborating on the idea that the emotionally relevant bodily changes are experienced as distinct stances we adopt towards specific objects. That is to say, we should conceive of emotions as distinctive types of bodily awareness, where the subject experiences her body holistically as taking an attitude towards a certain object. So the bodily dimension of emotion, everybody agrees that emotion characteristically has a bodily dimension, but here it plays a very crucial role in the theory. That bodily dimension, the visceral dimension of emotion, that's the thing that does the taking of a stance or an attitude towards an object. I created a visual aid for you. This is the kitten. Now, imagine that the kitten is sick, very sick, in fact. And you and your partner are very distressed by this. You really have a knot in your stomach. The knot in the stomach represents, because it's an unpleasant knot in the stomach, represents as bad the cat being sick. So this cat's sickness or illness is presented as bad by this unpleasant sensation. And that's what the emotion of distress is. It's the having of a bodily sensation that presents as bad a certain external state of affairs, according to Deona and Theoni. Now, Brentano has a different view. Brentano thinks, again, that the bodily sensations are actually part of the object of your overall emotion. In having an emotion, you also have a certain kinesthetic or proprioceptive perception of your state, the state of your body. And what you perceive is certain sensations. So this is part of what is being experienced. It's not part of the relationship of experiencing. It's not a modal or attitudinal feature. It's part of what is being experienced, the objects being experienced. So for him, the better diagram would be this. You have the cat, you have your sensations, admittedly. Now, you have an emotional state which has a sui generis, primitive way, non-bodily way, of presenting as good or bad the cat's illness. In this case, since it's distress, presenting as bad the cat's illness, the kitten's illness. But in addition, it has another dimension, your emotion, a proprioceptive dimension. It also presents as real a certain visceral, bodily event. Because proprioception is a kind of perception. Perception, what it presents as real. And so it presents as real the occurrence of the bodily sensations, in addition to presenting as bad the kitten's illness. These are just two things that happen together. But it's not that this happens via this. In fact, this is primary. This is the essential aspect of emotion. This bodily aspect is more of an accompaniment. It just comes along, but it's not the essence of emotion. The essence of emotion is the evaluation. It's a kind of sui generis primitive evaluation that you cannot account for in terms of anything more basic. And to me, this sounds plausible for the following reason. It seems to me that these kinds of visceral changes that happen, they're not in the stomach. In themselves, they're not really good or bad. They're just sensations. I mean, the same knot in the stomach that you can have about when you're distressed about the cat, it's experienced very negatively. But sometimes you get a sensation that's very similar when, when the... Do you have the sensation in your stomach sometimes when there are new elevators, when they go up, yeah, the stomach, there's a very distinctive sensation in your stomach, like it's going down somehow? Is that similar to the kind of sensation? If it's, you think just about the bodily dimension, isn't it very similar to the thing that's happening? Or yeah, when you have a roller coaster ride, you know, in the Tuileries in summer, there are these things where you can do these scary rides. And you may get the same sensation, and the sensation is unpleasant when you're, to me at least, it's unpleasant in those scary rides. But on the elevator, I kind of like it. It's a pleasant sensation for me, even though it's kind of the same sensation. So I don't think the sensations themselves are good or bad. They are good or bad if we experience them as good or experience them as bad. But this is my admittedly underdeveloped reason to think that it really goes, in my opinion, the other way around. This sensation is experienced as bad because the emotion presents as bad its object, the cat's illness. If we had another kind of emotion which presented as good, some state of affairs, maybe the same sensation would be experienced as a pleasant sensation. All right, so in summary, Brentano's view is really, let's do again the kind of taxonomy of possible views. So there are evaluative views of emotion, and then there are other views of emotion, like the James Lange theory is not an evaluative theory of emotion. The theory that was very common in the 60s, I think Singer was one of the first ones. Cognitive science, it's sort of psychological theory that emotion is just in a bodily arousal plus some kind of interpretation of it. These are all kinds of theories that are not evaluative necessarily, but then there are evaluative theories. And again, there will be evaluative theories that either reduce emotional evaluation to evaluative judgments or to evaluative perceptions, and will build the evaluation into the content of the emotion. In contrast, there are attitudinal theories that build the evaluation into the very mode of being related to the object. And finally, within these attitudinal evaluative theories, there will be two varieties. There's the Diona-Terroni view, where it's a bodily evaluating, versus the Brentano view, where it's kind of primitive, sui generis, irreducible, unanalyzable kind of presenting as good. So that's Brentano's view. All right, so I should go pretty quickly through the third part so we have time for discussion. But you'll notice that the theory of the will and the theory of emotion, it's the same theory. It's a theory that these states are essentially evaluative. They evaluate by using a kind of sui generis mode of relatedness to the object. And so, doesn't this suggest that will and emotion are in fact the very same type of mental state? There's a single kind of mental state which is either an emotion or a desire or an intention. And indeed, Brentano at one level says yes. He has a classification of mental phenomena, which Denis Seron discussed in the last meeting, where there are three classes of mental phenomena: presentations, judgments, and then the third class, which involves both emotion and the will, and in fact also feelings of pleasure and displeasure, because those two are evaluative. So he thinks there are judgments are states that present as true or false. Emotion, will, pleasure, all that presents as good or bad. And then there is a more fundamental kind of mental state, just presentation. It just presents something without commenting either on its truth or goodness, either on its truth or falsity, or on its goodness or badness. And this is Vorstellung. This is the most basic kind of mental state. But there's really just three fundamental classes. At the same time, what I think has been missed by Brentano scholars like Denis is that even when you accept, for example, when you accept that there is that in judgment, there judgment is one class of mental phenomena, you can still make sub-classification. You can find subspecies of the genus. For example, there's a difference between belief and disbelief, between believing that the weather is nice and disbelieving that the weather is nice. Both of them are judgments. One presents as true, one presents as false. So these are two different subclasses of the class of judgment. And so there are the fact that some mental phenomena belong to one fundamental class doesn't mean that that class does not have certain subclasses and that mental phenomena can be arranged there. And in my opinion, Brentano actually wanted the same thing for emotion and will. He wanted them to be two subclasses of this third category. And the reason this is not appreciated a lot is that to my knowledge, he tries to draw the distinction between will and emotion within that third class only in one place, a dictation from 1907 called Loving and Hating. And he does it in two pages. So there's two pages in the Brentano corpus, in my opinion, that address this issue. All right, so I was going to consider three options. See, I've been in France for 2.5 years. I've learned that in France your talk has to have three parts, but each part has three subparts. As I learned by fire, trial by fire, that this is how it should. So I made three parts to my three parts. And so I will skip though, so we have still time for discussion. I will skip maybe this idea that the difference between will and emotion is in the connection to action. I'll go straight to the idea that it's a matter of connection to preference, because that's something Brentano discusses in this 1907 dictation. He says this: I can thus want or desire a thing without at all. Oh no, that's here's the part where he links the difference between emotion and will to preference. He says some things are incompatible with others. A physical thing cannot be both round and square at one and the same time, or in motion and at rest, or liquid and solid, or red and blue all over. If someone desires or wills or wants that an object be one of these things, then he cannot at the same time reasonably desire, will, or want that it be the other way. But one can look favorably upon the object being one of these things, and at the same time also look favorably about its being the other. I think this is a very important passage where there's a distinction between desire and will on the one hand, and looking favorably on something, which is more of an emotional state. And what's the difference between these two, stated generally? We may say, therefore, that in order to become an object of will, want, or desire, the thing that is loved must be preferred not only to some one thing that is incompatible with it, but also to every possible object that is thought to be incompatible with it. So this is the key difference between emotion and will. When you're happy that something is the case, you present it as good, but you can also be happy with the opposite. So there's Michelle Montague has a paper on emotion where she gives the following example. Suppose I apply for a grant, INL, and only one person can get it. And I don't get it, and so I'm unhappy. But I learned that my favorite philosopher and best friend, so this is my best friend and favorite philosopher, she got it. So she got the grant. Only one of us could have gotten the grant. And maybe I even learned that we were the only candidates. It seems that I can be happy that she got it and unhappy that I did not get it, even though it's exactly the same event. There's only one event, which grad competition, where they say, this person's proposal is better than Kriegel's, so we'll give it to her. So it's the same event. I'm unhappy with it and I'm happy with it. They're incompatible, but it's perfectly rational to be happy, to have conflicting feelings about something. But it's not, Brentano says, it's not rational to have conflicting desires about it. You cannot both want to get the grant and want your best friend and favorite philosopher to get the grant if only one of you can have it. So desire, what desire does is that it commits not just to something being the object's existence being better than its non-existence. It commits to also it being better than all the other options that were available. So here's how I put it in my analytic style. We like variables. So for any subject S and intentional O, an intentional object O, For any subject S, Sophie, an intentional object O, getting the grant, S desires O if and only if, for any O star that cannot coexist with O, that is incompatible with O, S necessarily prefers O, O's existence, to O star's existence. All right? I'm going to repeat this. What does it mean for Sophie to desire to get the grant? It means that for any other event that's incompatible with her getting the grant, necessarily she prefers her getting the grant than this other event taking place. So any other alternative object, O star, she prefers O to O star. That's what it means for her to desire O. But that's not the case with positive emotion. You can have positive emotion towards O in virtue of preferring O's existence to O's non-existence. So what does it mean for me to be happy that I get the grant? It's to prefer that I get it than that I don't get it. That's the only preference. I prefer that the event takes place than that it doesn't take place. The positive emotion leaves it open that there may be some other event, O star, that cannot coexist with O, such that S does not prefer O, O's existence to O stars. Forget these formulas that I like. Instead, let's do an example that you go to a restaurant, it's time for dessert, they bring you the menu, there are three options. Chocolate cake, creme brulee, caramelized snails. Escargot or caramel. And so you immediately, you don't want the third option. You're just not an adventurous type. It doesn't sound that exciting, the adventure. But you're torn between the chocolate cake and the creme brulee. Now, let's add some more facts. Each of them is 7 euros. Each dessert is 7 euros. You have only 8 euros, 9 euros left, so you cannot have both. And you're also too full. But you know that once you will get it, because you already paid for it, you will eat both and then you'll feel disgusting. And so you decide to, you have to just take one. And so you have to choose between the chocolate cake and the creme brulee. Now you would be happy with a chocolate cake, you would be happy with a creme brulee, you have positive emotions towards both, whereas you don't have a positive emotion towards the caramelized snails. So let's say that you think the creme brulee is the best. That's what you choose. The chocolate cake is, you experience it as good, you experience the creme brulee as even better, and the caramelized snails is just bad. And now, you can rationally be happy with either the chocolate cake and the creme brulee, but you cannot rationally desire both the chocolate cake and the creme brulee, claims Brentano. If you decide to be rational in your desires, your will, for your will to be rational, it has to pick one, rather than the other. So it has to present creme brulee as not just good, but better than all the other options. One way to put the distinction is in terms of two kinds of goodness. So let's take another example. Soon it will be April, and in April I will have this problem that I will want. There will be chocolate cakes that I will want to eat, and at the same time, I will want to lose weight before summer comes, before the Plage de Paris arrives. And so I think it's good to eat the chocolate cake, but it's only prima facie good. It's not ultima facie good, because there's other consideration. There's something else that I want even more, which is to be thin and pretty for the Plage de Paris. In August. And so let's take this distinction between prima facie good, prima facie good, and ultima facie good. What you experience the chocolate cake is when you would be happy with it, but you don't think it's the best option, is that it's prima facie good. But you experience the creme brulee as something stronger than that. It's ultima facie good. It's not just good relative to some of the other options, it's good relative to all the other alternatives. And my suggestion is to understand Brentano as saying this is the essence of the difference between emotion and will. Both are evaluative, but positive emotions present what they do as prima facie good, whereas the will represents what it does as ultima facie good. So, I can be happy both about my best friend getting the grant and me not getting the grant, because I present, by my happiness presents as prima facie good, both of these scenarios. But it cannot present as ultima facie good, both of these scenarios. Only one of them can be ultima facie good. And so, what I want is that I will get the grant, let's say. And so that's my desire, even though I'm happy either way. And so this is the attitudinal approach to the difference that I propose to read in, from, to get from Brentano. Both of them present as good. It's that special way that they relate to objects, the emotion and the will. They present as good. But one presents as prima facie good, and the other presents as ultima facie good. Here is how I state it in my favored analytic style. For any subject S, an intentional object O, S desires O, if and only if, S's state presents as good sub UF. This is, presents as ultima facie good, O. S has a merely positive emotion towards O, if and only if. S's state. This is C'est seulement si, if and only if.
It's if has only one F.
Yes. This is used only in mathematics and in analytic philosophy, to my knowledge. It's a special, I should have said that, I apologize. If and only if is written like this in those two sub-literatures. But I messed up something in my formulation. I'm going to fix it now. And here is my good formulation. For any subject O, subject S, and object O, S desires O, if and only if S's state presents as good UF, so ultima facie good, O. S has merely a positive emotion towards O, if and only if S's state presents as good PF, so presents as prima facie good, O. Right? That's the difference between will and emotion that I find in those two pages in Brentano's dictation from 1907. So that's, I'm going to finish with that. That's conclusion. Do I have a conclusion at the end of all this? The conclusion that I have, yes, I make a revision at the end, it doesn't matter. Here's the conclusion. The conclusion is Brentano has an evaluative theory of will. He thinks states of the will are essentially states that present as good their object. So they evaluate the object, and the evaluation is part, it's not part of what is experienced, it's part of the way of the experiencing is done. And now the same thing happens with emotion. Positive emotions present as good their objects. Negative emotions present as bad their objects. They are evaluative, and it's part of the very mode of relating to the object, the evaluation. But there is still a difference. So they both belong to one fundamental class. Brentano explicitly uses this expression, fundamental class. But there might be non-fundamental class, subclasses of the fundamental class. And emotion and will, as I understand Brentano, are two different subclasses of that fundamental class. And what's the difference between them? Ultimately, it's the difference between presenting as ultima facie good, which is characteristic of the will, and presenting as prima facie good, which is characteristic of positive emotions. Thank you.